Hello and welcome to Ace Pod episode 3.8. This is the post Wisconsin ass beating and post Mike Hart hiring episode of the Ace Pod. We are brought to you as always by the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship. Joining me tonight, Dan, also known as Thick Stauskas. How you feeling post Hart?
Pretty tremendous. Not pretty tremendous. I thought you were going to say post-Wisconsin, so I was getting ready to be a lot happier.
That works too.
So Mike Hart's actually, this isn't actually an I'm so young thing. I didn't become a real Michigan fan until like 2011.
Oh God, I asked the wrong person.
So Mike Hart, but I mean, like, I understand what Mike Hart meant to this program, and like the little brother moment is like still very funny for me, and you know, lives on and rent free in the heads of every Spartan fan. So you know, I think that's a no brainer hire, and you know, I'm glad they did it. So you know, he gets points for the easy ones, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And my other guest tonight, Connor, is not with us. And instead, to react to just a beautiful game against Wisconsin, Alex Cook, how you doing, man?
Great. Got to say that was one of the most beautiful games I've ever seen. I just am chilling here in the castle, writing about the experience of living in the Rust Belt's greatest monstrosity. I actually made French onion soup for dinner in honor of Matt Campbell. It was delicious. And I'm ready to get going with you guys here on the Ace Pod.
Sweet. And just let the people know where they can find your castle blog.
That's grandvillain.com. We can place a link in the show notes.
We will have it in there. But y'all should really check that out. Alex can really write. I know you guys should know that already, but, you know, read his stuff. We are going to just cackle about Wisconsin for a little bit before getting into some reader questions. Although the first question will actually be a nice way to start us off, because it's from our friend Eric Petey, and he asks... doesn't ask, just request. Let Bonds vamp on basketball and how it makes him happy for 2 minutes. So, Alex, just go ahead. We can put you on the clock here. 2 minutes. Go.
You know, the reaction to this ass beating in the corners of the Michigan internet's been great. I don't know that I've seen a more fun game other than perhaps, maybe the Florida game in the tournament or the A&M game in the tournament. But to see Michigan just so emphatically destroy a veteran Wisconsin team on both ends of the floor and just... they took them out of their offense. They made them look like a sub 300 compound team that just, you know, goes in, takes a check, and quits sometime in the second half. And to see, I mean, Michigan's effort on the defensive end, the execution on the offensive end, how well the players play to their strengths and really kind of cohere into a good 6-7-8 man unit really speaks to Juwan's ability as a coach, especially because this roster came together kind of late. But yeah, I mean, Michigan, great shots on offense, move the ball so well, and they just make life miserable for opponents. So I don't know, it definitely blunts the sadness or melancholy of having a horrible football program right now, I have to say. You know, since I arrived at Michigan as an undergrad in 2012, basketball definitely has been the better program. I've had way fonder memories of Chrysler, and the stewardship of the program under Juwan Howard is so exciting. You know, I mean, John Beilein to me was kind of synonymous with Michigan basketball, given that we never even made the tournament when I was growing up, but now we're just calmly destroying top 10 teams and looking like a bona fide one seed and championship contender. So the vibes could not be better for basketball in conclusion.
Perfect. That was 20 seconds short of 2 minutes.
So I have a little bit more time. You know, it's crazy that, I mean, granted, it's a really high bar, but that was Hunter Dickinson's, I guess, relative worst game of the season, and Michigan still was so dominant against Wisconsin. It's great.
That's something that I meant to note in the recap and didn't really do a good job of, is just like, he didn't even play 20 minutes in that game. And that I think is for Michigan to just mollywop one of the like 10 best teams in the country, I think, like, almost without question.
In a program that's synonymous with consistency and, I guess, stability like Wisconsin, they looked really rattled.
Yeah, and I mean, and Brian ran off all these stats in the recap today about how, I mean, that Wisconsin just does not get blown out like this. And for Michigan to not only do it, but to do it with their best player having one of his least impactful games, it says a lot about what this team is like. I mean, I can't even put into words what I'm feeling about this game still, and we're a day removed from it now, because I'm just giddy about what the upside of this team is.
Yeah, it definitely looks like a team that could be en route for a potential Big Ten championship, potential run to the Final Four. And like you said, with Dickinson not playing that well by his standards, there's a lot of guys who can step up on a given night and be Michigan's go-to scorer. Like, I look at Mike Smith and how well he played against Wisconsin. He had some really impressive takes. Like, that step back on Davison was nice. He blew by Aleem Ford after just juking him out of his shoes. And, you know, we kind of wondered, okay, Mike Smith, he could put up empty calorie numbers against Ivy League teams. How would he do against, you know, really strong defensive teams in the Big Ten like Wisconsin? And the answer is pretty damn good.
Yeah, not only that, but his defense is coming around too. So if you can cut out a few of the, particularly the dead ball turnover, or the non-steal turnovers where he's, you know, throwing it out of bounds or traveling. I mean, we've talked about this a lot on the MGO podcast, but there are some turnovers that seem like they shouldn't be too difficult to cut out of his game if he can just kind of cut a little bit more of the, like, I have to do everything because I'm the man at Columbia and our team sucks kind of aspect to his game. And I think there's a settling in period that's still happening right now, and Smith is really coming through to the point where I'm no longer complaining constantly about how Chandy Brown should play more minutes.
Right, and I mean, pretty much any criticism of the team at this point has to be taken with a huge grain of salt, given their run of form lately. Like, nobody's playing better in the entire country than Michigan. So, you know, we can see potential flaws that might be exploited by the right team here or there, or, you know, potential worry spots. But Michigan's undefeated, and, you know, based on KenPom probability, could be for at least, you know, a little while longer.
Yeah, and I mean, they look like a national title contender. That was the immediate talk on ESPN after the game, and I'm willing to accept that. The next question is an easy one to answer. It's from Wade Goodell. Have you located your pants from last night? The answer is no, Wade. The answer is absolutely not. In fact, I'm not sure pants exist anymore.
So, Ace, when did the pants go off last night?
Oh, man, that's a good question. Probably, I'm not sure when I tweeted it. It was probably during the 14-0 run to close the first half. At the very latest, it was during that half-ending possession when they just shut down Wisconsin for, like, I don't know, something like 45 seconds because of knocking the ball out of bounds off of rebounds. Like, it just one of the most remarkable defensive sequences. Maybe the best defensive sequence I've ever seen Michigan play, to be honest. for that long, for that period of time, against a team at that high level, to dominate them to the point where they couldn't even get a shot off was just, it was erotic. So that's my answer to that question. And we can move on from it because we don't need to talk anymore about me not wearing pants. The next question comes from Adam via email. What's the scariest Big Ten team left on the schedule for Michigan? Is it Iowa because of having to keep pace with their super efficient offense, or perhaps Illinois because of Io's size and driving ability? Alex, I'll throw this one to you before I give my thoughts on this.
I definitely would go with Iowa. Adam was completely right in describing the reasons why you would be concerned by each team, and Illinois has a lot of talent that can physically match up with Michigan. There's not a ton of teams at the college level that can. But in terms of Iowa's scoring ability, Garza's presence around the basket and ability to draw fouls potentially on Hunter Dickinson, as well as, they could win a 90-85 game. it'll be really interesting to see how well Michigan's defense can match up with Iowa's offense, because I'm pretty sure Michigan would be able to score at will on Iowa for the most part, unless open threes aren't falling. But just, I guess, because of Garza, I'm more worried about Iowa. Illinois, their defense isn't super great. I think Michigan could exploit them, and I don't know. I think they could leverage Iowa into some tough shots, and, you know, if he's scoring contested mid-range shots all game, then you kind of got to tip your hat at that point. Iowa and Illinois kind of stand at the top. As far as the rest of the teams, I know Indiana's kind of a mess, but they also have a very good big man. And then, yeah, I don't know. There's not a lot of teams that match up well with Michigan.
Yeah, outside of this top, I would still say top four, because I think going back, I have a lot of confidence in Michigan's ability to go back and win at Wisconsin. But I can see that being a very different game. Especially if, you know, you get a couple cold calls early. You never know. And I'm with you. I do think Iowa is the more dangerous team just because they can shoot over Michigan's defense. And Illinois, I mean, Maryland laid a pretty nice blueprint. If you have an elite kind of wing defender in Daryl Morsell, like they did, or say Shondi Brown and Eli Brooks, like Michigan has, especially Shondi Brown in the Illinois game, with that added size, because DeSumo's 6'5". You know, they were just, if you have a guy who can stick with him and force him left, he's not necessarily going to have the most efficient game. And he didn't have a very efficient one against Maryland, and even though Coburn went off against them, Maryland was able to win. So I just, there's a very easy path to, not necessarily easy, but there's a blueprint, I think, that's been laid out for Michigan versus Illinois that's not necessarily laid out for how to beat Iowa, or just the beat Iowa blueprint can be blown up by them having a hot shooting game. So it just feels like the most dangerous matchup in the league right now. Dan, you got any thoughts on this one?
My only thoughts are that, first of all, I do agree that Iowa is the scarier team, just because Michigan does tend to give up a couple of pretty wide open threes every half, and Iowa's probably going to put those down more than other teams. And I think that, you know, Michigan's just so strong on both ends that I'm not worried about them matching up with, like, any normal team, and I don't consider Iowa like a normal team, because it's just, they're such a freak show on offense and then such a terrible defensive team. So I just think Iowa has the potential to just, you know, outscore Michigan. But I will say that it's nice that with both of these teams, Michigan can afford to just not beat them and still probably win the Big Ten in the regular season, because they only play them each once, right?
That's true. You make a good point there. Michigan does have, of the top teams in the conference, the schedule that best lines up for them to win an outright title. So especially if they take, I would say, at least one of those two games, then they're looking pretty good as long as they don't trip up. Especially since I think because of their defense, Iowa's a team that's prone to tripping up a little bit. And we've already seen that happen with Illinois. We've already seen Michigan beat Wisconsin about as badly as I've seen them beat anybody not named like Houston Baptist over the last several years. So that, I mean, it feels like they got a pretty good path here. They seemingly match up well against most teams in the league. Iowa is the one where that's in a little bit of question, especially when you've got a player who's as good as Luka Garza, and he's got, you know, he's a senior, Hunter Dickinson is a freshman. We have seen Dickinson get, you know, worked in the post a couple times when teams have been able to do that. Michigan has also just gotten big enough leads that teams really haven't been able to run much post offense. You know, we could see Garza maybe with a couple of his double pivots. Nate Reavers got Dickinson with one last night. Iowa could put up some points. We'll see. Iowa will put up some points. It's a matter of how many they give up for the most part, but they could give Michigan more trouble than anybody. The next one comes from @DJ Corndog. What are the biggest areas of improvement for Franz Wagner, Isaiah Livers, and anyone else you merit talking about between this year and last? Alex, is there like an improvement from one of those guys that, jumps out the most to you?
I think there's an improvement that each of them both made kind of on their own, just their ability to share the ball and pass. I've definitely seen more advanced pick and roll ball handling from each of them. I've definitely seen them pass up a lot of good shots to kind of swing the ball and get great shots. And I don't know, the assist to turnover ratio for each looks pretty good. As far as an improvement that Franz made, the biggest thing for him, I think, is just the physical improvement. He seems to have gotten a little bit taller. He's clearly put on a lot of muscle. Last year, he really looked like a freshman. This year, he looks like an NBA player. And the impact he makes on defense with his length and strength is really impressive. Both of them kind of have shown a little bit out of the pick and roll ball handling to the point where they can kind of be secondary creators. Like, I don't necessarily think they could be ball dominant players, but you know, Franz was mostly a driver and a scorer earlier in his career. Isaiah was mostly just a spot up shooter, and they've diversified their game a lot.
Absolutely. I mean, we saw Livers make a little behind the back flip in this game to get an assist on a three pointer to, I believe, Shondi Brown, if I remember the gif I just made correctly. And, you know, Wagner's been piling up the assists recently. This team moves the ball beautifully. And, you know, the physical improvement from Wagner is apparent. I'll add that his just general sense of defense and timing and passing lanes has really, it just gets seemingly better by the game. I'm starting to have a tough time keeping track of how many deflections he's getting on a game-to-game basis, because he just gets his hand on the ball all the dang time, whether it's from helping or just playing straight up on his man. And that's come such a long way from where he was last year, and it makes a massive difference for this team. For Livers, I agree with you that his passing is the biggest thing, and I think the next thing that will come around for him is his decision making on when to drive and when to shoot. We are seeing some marginal game to game improvements. I think he got a little bit of a wake up call after some turnovers against Minnesota. Was better at picking his spots driving in against Wisconsin. So we'll see if that holds. That's kind of the next thing for him. Dan, is there anybody else that you see that's kind of jumped out for something that's changed from last year?
Yeah, no, I mean, I just think I can't say enough about how much better Franz looks. I mean, you guys are both much more trained eyes than I am, but I, you know, last year it was always there was something off. You know, it was either his shooting and he was just not quite putting it together. And this year, like, I think if it weren't for Hunter Dickinson, he'd be getting much more love. You know, nationally, because, you know, Hunter's kind of soaking up all the spotlight right now, and Franz is just quietly, you know, a terror. I mean, just everything with Franz has improved, and it's really impressive.
And we'll keep the Franz hype train rolling with the next question from at NaptownJazz12. Is Franz the most versatile / best defender since the Fab Five? The most versatile aspect adds a really interesting twist to this, because pure best defender Charles Matthews, I think, has to be at least mentioned here, because not only was he a hell of a shutdown defender at Michigan, but he also was locking down guys at the NBA Combine to the point where he was getting into the draft discussion, even though his offense was kind of a mess before he had his knee injury. So I do want to mention Charles Matthews. Other than that, I mean, there's certainly nobody from growing up for me that stands out as a very good defender. So at that point, I mean, when you add in the versatility, it's tough to even get into a discussion, except for maybe is Franz the best defender on this team? Alex, I'll throw that one to you.
I would say that he probably is the best defender on this team, both as like a point of attack defender and off the ball, to your point. You know, his reading of the game has become really advanced to the point where his steals, deflections, blocks, he's pretty much everywhere on defense. I would say, you know, I can't imagine that many other Michigan players dating back to the Fab Five or even before that could credibly guard 1 through 5 in college basketball. But you kind of saw that with Northwestern. He guarded the 5 in Pete Nance. Against Illinois, you got to think that he could be an option against Io DeSumo, who is their point guard at 6'5". And, you know, ultimately, I don't have that great of a reservoir of Michigan basketball knowledge dating back to the Fab Five. I don't remember the LRB era. I remember the Amaker era vaguely.
And
yeah, it wasn't very good either. But yeah, in terms of the Beeline era, Charles Matthews stands out to me as probably the best. But I think you could make a case for Franz. And yeah, I don't know. I don't think you would put Brooks or Livers potentially over, or even maybe Brown over Wagner. I think I would take Wagner over Brown in terms of the best defenders on this Michigan team.
His ability to guard multiple positions really makes a difference, and I think that might end up being the key to this team making a very deep run in the NCAA tournament this year. With that, we're going to take a quick break, come back on the other side, and talk some more basketball.
When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters in venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email jason@blankenshiplawyer.com.
Push the tempo, 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 push the tempo.
All right, welcome back. We start our second consecutive Hoops segment because why mess with a good thing by seeing, you know, if this good thing could possibly end, because this is how Michigan fans are. So the first question of this segment is, do you worry about the basketball team peaking too early? That is from at Bergskid Bowl. Alex, I will throw this to you.
Not really.
Good answer. I don't either. I think we can move on. I mean, you know, they're playing really well. I would not complain about a team playing very well, especially when there are actually a lot of areas of this team where it seems like they've got upside to explore, whether it's the continued improvement of Wagner and Livers as secondary creators, Mike Smith cutting out some turnovers, the return of Austin Davis, giving you some more versatility with Brandon Johns. You know, there's still some upside to explore for this team, I think. So I'm not worried about them peaking early.
I also think like the energy on this team is so, and I know that's like a corny thing to say, but this just doesn't feel like a team that's like riding high. It feels like a team of veterans and guys that are coming out like excited to play every night. So I don't worry about, you know, they're going to lose at some point, and when that happens, I don't necessarily worry about it like derailing the season.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point. There are a few of these guys that have lost a national championship game before. And, you know, a lot of the guys on this team who lost an opportunity, they felt, to make a run in the tournament last year. So, I mean, just because Hunter Dickinson is the centerpiece of this team doesn't mean this is an inexperienced team. If you look at Michigan's effective experience on KenPom, they're 64th in the country. They're well above average. And, you know, and you hear every game about how Dickinson is an old freshman, too. So this, I think, is a very mature team, and that's something that's going to help them ride both the highs and the lows of the season. And right now it seems like they're handling the highs of it quite well. Next question comes from at TI Shield. What's this team's biggest exploitable weakness and how could it hurt them? Unforced turnovers have been an issue that pops up but aren't exactly on the other team. Is depth something that could crop up with injury, COVID, foul trouble? Alex, you got one on this? I have a feeling I know exactly where this is going.
I would always worry in college basketball about an injury or potentially foul trouble hitting a team. Like if, you know, Michigan lost one of its wings, depth there would be pretty thin. Between Brooks and Smith, you really only have two guards that you trust. So I think that would probably be the biggest case. And obviously with the virus, that's also a factor potentially.
Yeah, I agree with you that... I mean, if we're talking about if we're removing injury and COVID from the situation, just because those are very uncontrollable things, Hunter Dickinson has done a very good job of avoiding foul trouble. But there is inevitably going to be a game where the, you know, a 7-foot center picks up some early fouls. It's just going to happen. I've never seen a center make it through an entire season without getting into foul trouble, playing as many minutes as Dickinson, especially in a league with as many good and large big men that command the ball as the Big Ten. So that seems like something that could hurt them. If we're talking about something that isn't just like one of our good players is sitting on the bench, I guess it would be if a team has a large backcourt that skilled.
Yeah, I would say big scoring guards. Like you look at Jalen Suggs at Gonzaga, potentially, not to get too far ahead of ourselves speculating about that kind of matchup. But yeah, that would be something that I think from like a schematic perspective or like, you know, where does our personnel have a weakness? Large scoring guards, you know, potentially you could put Shaundi Brown on that guy. But, you know, if a team has multiple options, and some size in the backcourt, that could be tricky for us.
Yeah, and also this team has been functioning very well with those two guards out there. So you don't want to have to be forced to adjust to the other team. Juwan Howard very much seems to prefer sticking to his... I mean, he'll adjust if he has to, But he seems to like kind of sticking to his normal rotation as much as he can. So that could be something that throws things off a little bit. We'll see.
I'll also say that I think, like, you know, we kind of got our five-out offense test against Northwestern, but they did sort of get away with that because they could stick Dickinson on that kid from Northwestern who I'm drawing a blank on, but he, like...
Robbie Barron.
Like, zero usage. So, like, not many teams have a... Or, like, not many good teams have a player with, like, zero usage like that. So, I would say, I mean, like, look, they kind of blitzed Wisconsin, but, like, a really good, you know, five-out team that can make Dickinson, you know, come out to the perimeter, I think still could at least be, like, a defensive weakness for this team.
Our answers keep basically coming back to Gonzaga, and I'm really enjoying that. So, this is good. Speaking of the rotation, we got a couple questions here from Dr. Garbs on Twitter. Terrence Williams had a more expansive role early in the season, which is pared down during Big Ten play. Have you seen anything out of him that warrants the minutes reduction, or is this a function of Juwan tightening rotations and conference play? Related, what bench mob member do you think has the best chance to make an unexpected important contribution in a game down the stretch? Alex, I'll throw it to you first.
I don't think it's anything necessarily that we saw from Williams that warranted the minutes reduction. I think just with college basketball, you can kind of afford to play pretty short rotations. You know, having eight guys seems to be eight or nine guys is the optimal number with Davis back, Michigan's at eight. So I think it's just kind of tightening the rotation down. As for the related question, I think Williams or potentially Zeb Jackson would be that guy. Juwan definitely seems to prefer to play the starters quite a bit, you know, even well into blowouts, and doesn't seem to, you know, put many of the quote unquote scout team guys in with major rotation players aside from Williams earlier in the season. Just because we've seen the most of him, I would say, you know, a big rebound or a big defensive stop, you could potentially see something like that in the tournament.
Yeah, I mean, when Michigan played a relatively close game against Maryland until late without Austin Davis available, it was a straight-up seven-man rotation. Terrence Williams didn't even see the floor. And I think, you know, that's probably what we're going to see more of heading forward, unless one of the freshmen really has kind of a light bulb comes on moment. But to echo what you said, it's not necessarily anything Terrence Williams did. I think he's been okay for a freshman.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the depth chart at his positions, you know, where he could theoretically play, he's kind of blocked by Davis at the five and Johns at the four. And yeah, I mean, between the glut of wings on the team too, it's going to be hard for him to compete to get minutes. And the fact that he did play earlier in the season is more of a positive sign about his potential development rather than his, you know, ability to contribute a ton on this team.
Absolutely. And I think I'm inclined to say that Zeb Jackson would be the bench player who could end up with kind of that, you know, like, gets a game named after him because of a unexpected 10-minute stretch kind of thing. Because, you know, if Michigan does run into a team where tall guards, you know, a tall backcourt is killing them, maybe a backcourt where you got Zeb and Shondi Brown out there is the answer in certain situations, especially if Zeb is able to do some things offensively. And he had a really smooth pull-up. You know, kind of the other starters against Wisconsin, and I could see him coming around after a little bit of a rough start, mostly playing with the, you know, end of the bench guys. Where once he gets in there with the starters a little bit more, he could maybe surprise some people, but I think it's more likely you just basically see Juwan Howard keep it at seven or eight guys per game. And let's see here. The next one is via email from Bill. This is a fun one. Who was the last Michigan freshman in either football or basketball to be a Hunter Dickinson level positive surprise? Is it Trey Burke, Mike Hart? I guess at Prest, I'd quantify positive surprise as not a five-star talent because that makes it not as much of a surprise. Starting or playing impactful minutes because it's not just, hey, this guy shows some great leaping ability on his four catches this year. Boy, we've been burned before, haven't we?
Ooh, that hurts. That hurts.
Yeah. Top half of the conference out of position. Thanks, Bill. Very Michigan to have several bullet points in an email. Very Michigan to have the bullet points be those specific bullet points. Thank you, Bill. I appreciate it. And I'm being very earnest when I say that, too. Alex, did a player come to mind? Because for me, it was Trey Burke.
Yeah, Bill was right that it was Trey Burke. Dickinson, All-American, potentially second or third team behind Garza. Trey Burke was National Player of the Year as a sophomore. So, you know, in terms of comparable, like, holy cow, this guy is a really dominant player who could potentially get his jersey in the Raptors someday. Trey Burke is the guy that comes to mind.
Yeah, because we were expecting Burke to leave after, I mean, you know, he had maybe cleaned out his dorm room. And especially considering that Burke also was not considered to be near Dickinson's level as a recruit either. And I would say that's the pretty easy answer to that one.
Mike Hart is a good answer, though, in keeping with the theme of the show of talking about football for some reason.
Yes.
The only positive surprise I can think of for football is, like, in recent memory, is Blake Countess, who is, like, the only, like, decent freshman to end up. I guess Blake Countess or Mason Cole, but, like, neither of them are Hunter Dickinson level, obviously.
Yeah, no, those are good answers for the football team and also bleak answers because that's what it's been like for the football team.
Hey, Nico Kylens was really good, though, Ace.
I have him on my my dynasty team in fantasy, so I'm going to hopefully get some more out of Nico Kylens' football career when he's a professional than I was able to when he was in college.
Yeah, he's going to be like a fifth round pick or something. And then, you know, by week six, everybody in the NFL is going to be like, oh my God, who is that? Holy
oh, he God. Was like a, he was like a flip in a trade where it was like, man, I know I'm the biased Michigan guy, but I feel like I'm getting really good value here. So I'm happy to have him and a little bummed out. Next question. I chose one of two counterfactual questions that were posed to me, and it's the one that hasn't been asked a bunch of times before. And this one is interesting, but I think I come down pretty squarely on one side. It's from Smoothatron. Would you trade Mike Smith for last year's Xavier Simpson? And on this team, I would not.
Oh, man, I think I would still. I think I would. The floor spacing that Smith provides over Simpson is nice, but, you know, theoretically, if you could engineer a team that doesn't have such a reliance on Simpson's pick and roll game, I think his defensive effort would be even more outstanding, and Michigan would go from like number 12 in KenPom defense to like maybe top 3, top 5. So,
I mean,
yeah,
I just think they're going to get there anyway.
Potentially, yeah. I think that, yeah, the argument for Smith is that he can get his shot more and can play, I guess, more within the offense as a spot-up shooter. To your point earlier in the podcast, his defense has been better than expected as of late. But, yeah, I mean, X was an all-conference player last year. I don't know that Smith is an all-conference player this year.
Dan, sorry, I cut you off earlier.
Oh, no. I'm taking X no matter what, like, pretty much in any situation. Like, I can't bring myself to say, you know, like, I like Mike Smith. Like, I really like what he's brought to the team this year, and we're, like, certainly lucky to have him. But if I could have this team plus Xavier Simpson, I mean, I don't know. That just sounds like the best possible scenario.
Yeah, and I mean, to be clear, no slight towards Smith, who is being compared to one of the recent fan favorites of Michigan basketball. But yeah, Simpson's demeanor, his impact on the team, I think, you know, last year was a little weird with injuries and everything, and obviously the season getting canceled. But yeah, I think I would have to go with X there. So a little bit of disagreement on the Ace Pod.
I know. It surprised me a little bit. I don't know. I don't want to mess with the extremely good thing that's happening with this year's team.
Right. That's true. That's a good point.
So much of what Howard is running on offense relies on everyone on the court being an offensive threat. And as soon as you take that away, I mean, we've seen how much different this offense looks with the same coach. And obviously, I mean, Dickinson is a game-changing player in terms of how, you know, changing the way you run your offense. But Michigan has added a whole lot of other stuff, and is that running that stuff when Brandon Johns is at center too, that we didn't see before because Simpson and that, and you know, John Beilein even had trouble getting great offenses out of Xavier Simpson team. So I think if you're looking for a team that's going to be national championship caliber, I mean, there is kind of a hard and fast rule about being top 20 in both offense and defense on KenPom. That applies, I think, to like every recent national championship except one of the flukier UConn teams. So for me, it's hard to squeeze that top 20 defense out of an offense with Xavier Simpson. It isn't with Mike Smith, and meanwhile, Michigan already has easily a top 20 defense, I would say, once things come together with Mike Smith out there. So, well, yeah, a little bit of disagreement, but I like that question, and I like it better than talking about Isaiah Todd and Josh Christopher again, which is why I deleted that question. Next one is from at Reed Tweets. Of the remaining first 13 games, would you be more surprised by finishing with 0-1 losses or 5+ losses? Alex, I'll let you answer that one first.
I would definitely be surprised with 0 or 1 losses. Just with cumulative probability, it seems pretty unlikely. 5+ losses, say somebody potentially gets sick with a virus that's rampaging through the country still, and misses a game without Michigan having games canceled, that could potentially cause big problems. Sorry to be a Debbie Downer. But yeah, just I would go with 5 or more.
No, I mean, you made the correct math answer there. You know, KenPom probabilities, he's got Michigan projected to go 15-4. Torvik, which includes the postponed games in his calculations, has us at 16-4. Either way, you know, 5 wins certainly is closer to the probability than 0-1. To play devil's advocate for a moment, I do like Michigan in every single individual matchup moving forward. It's just, you know, yeah, it is one of those things where you do expect at some point they're going to get tripped up. I mean, they already have played a close game against Penn State, you know, a half against Maryland where Maryland absolutely caught fire.
Almost lost to Oakland.
Yeah, that was enough of a weird one that I'm willing to just kind of throw that out as a game that happened, because I don't think any Big Ten team is going to come out and play exclusively zone.
Right.
And that was also Hunter Dickinson's second game. So, I mean, like the Oakland game, I am more willing to ignore. But, like, you know, the Penn State game happened. That was not that long ago. That was a 4-point win at home over a team that's just not very good, at least by Big Ten standards, because every team in the Big Ten is good except Nebraska. But Michigan does not play Nebraska again for the rest of the season. So, I mean, everyone in this conference is dangerous, and that makes it hard to pick the 0 or 1 losses, even though my heart really wants to.
So let me ask this. What's the max losses that you think, or I guess what does Michigan have to go to like be in play for a 1 seed?
That's a good question. I would say it does depend, too, on whether they win the Big Ten tournament, I would think.
Or if there is one.
Or if there is one, yep. But I think 16-4, you're looking at a 1 seed there.
Yeah, no, I think that's a pretty fair call. I could even see it happening at 15-5, given the strength of the Big Ten, depending on what happens with teams around them. Bartorvik has Michigan projected as a 1 seed right now, although Michigan is also undefeated. So that makes it easier. And Michigan is the top 2 seed on the bracket matrix, and that was with some weird outlier brackets that should be thrown in the trash can, to be honest, because Michigan is not a 4 seed. That is stupid. There's at least one of those that was updated today. I will not name names because I am a very nice person on the internet, as we all know.
We're all sweet boys online here.
Oh, most definitely. Dan in particular.
I've never been mean to anyone on the internet.
Oh, God. We should move on from this before we get ourselves in trouble. Last question for this one comes from at CT Go Wolves. Can you talk a little about where Naz Hillman stands in the Women's Player of the Year conversation? I dug around a little bit before the podcast on this one because I can't say I was like intimately familiar with the Player of the Year candidates heading into this season. But looking into it, I think Hillman has a pretty decent chance because it was kind of assumed to be Ryan Howard's award to lose. She's a guard for Kentucky who led the country in scoring last year, which is not something that happens very much with Power 5 players. But her numbers have come down this year. They've had a new coach. They've had some changeover in that team. She's even got some like kind of player of the year level-ish competition from other players on her own team. And then there isn't really anybody that jumps out, at least statistically, from the, you know, projected one seeds and UConn and South Carolina, which is kind of how the top six is right now. So, and then when you look at the rest of the country, Naz Hillman's numbers are as good as anybody's, both in the raw numbers or, you know, she's leading the country in win shares per hoop stats, if you want to use some advanced numbers. And she is also number one in PER. So she's got some impressive statistical bona fides to lean back on. And I think it will depend on whether Michigan can kind of push towards being a top four-ish seed or if they're kind of fall back. I think they probably need to win the Big Ten for Hillman to be a National Player of the Year contender, but I will admit a relatively high level of ignorance when it comes to how this all works in the women's basketball world. So we'll see. I mean, if Paige Beckers, the tremendously talented freshman at UConn, comes on and has a really strong finish to the season, she's already off to a good start and had a huge amount of hype heading into this year, then it might be hers to lose. But if Naz Hillman keeps putting up 30-20s, at some point it might be very difficult to make an argument for someone else. So we'll see how it unfolds. I'm very excited to keep watching this women's team. And unfortunately, we're now about to talk about something we're less excited about, although at least they got Mike Hart. On the other side of this break, we're talking football, at least briefly. Sorry to do this, but we're talking football. First of all, this is the first podcast we've had since Harbaugh officially signed his extension. So we should at least get our thoughts out there on the pod. I mean, I've already put mine out there on the MGO podcast. I think everyone has a pretty good sense of how I feel. Probably has a good sense of how we all feel, to be honest, but we might as well do this anyway. Dan, we're going to do the let the dog out of the backyard thing again. Go.
Before I start, I just want to make sure that, you have deleted all the old episodes of the Ace Pod where we all had various versions of the, oh, this is definitely trending towards Harbaugh leaving take.
yeah, well, no, we've wiped them all clean. That never
yeah, happened. So I can't afford to be wrong on the internet. It would ruin my mystique. I guess in the grand, I'm gonna try not to be just like angry because I feel like I've, you know, beaten that horse to death. But I don't know. I guess I will say that if they brought him back, at least, you know, the contract signals that they know that the performance thus far has not been, you know, up to expectations. And it's a very Michigan-friendly contract that, you know, I mean, it's quite frankly unprecedented in major college football for a coach to take a pay cut like this, which, you know, is part of the reason that it made me mad, because it just doesn't feel like something a serious program would do. But nevertheless, it's a Michigan-friendly contract, and, you know, it makes it very easy to fire him if things go badly next year. You know, I just continue to be worried that he's gonna have, we're gonna have like a dead cat bounce next year and just be in dumb limbo for another offseason. That's kind of where I'm at.
I used that exact same phrase when talking to my therapist about the football team. That's not a revealing statement or anything. Alex, I think you and Dan are trading off Connor's vibes guy duties this podcast. How are you feeling with the vibes around this move?
I mean, to me, the Harbaugh era died when they lost to the Mel Tucker year zero Michigan State team at home. To me, that was the end, and everything else after that is some sad, cruel nightmare. I think Michigan is a strong candidate to potentially regress the mean next year, but I don't know. I think the program would have been better to move on. I do think Harbaugh maybe should be getting a little bit more grace for the oddities of the Corona year and losing some of his best players to opt outs and then injuries. But the vibes around the program were just abysmal, and I don't know if turning over the coaching staff helps that. I think college football history would probably tell you, for the most part, it does not. Once regimes get to the point where they're firing the longtime defensive coordinator and trying to replace assistants, usually pretty bad. So, I don't know. Next fall, I'll be thinking about how Rocket Watts is going to try to score over Hunter Dickinson, Musa Jabate, and Caleb Houston at the rim.
That's the ticket. I mean, I'm at least... At least they have an out, and a relatively easy one, because next year the optics will be a lot better for them to fire a coach. Hopefully it better not be a COVID year. I've had enough of that. I think we all have. More than that, our fill. He at least, you know, bringing in Mike Hart, you know, that's something that hopefully will stick whether or not Harbaugh does, because Hart is a really promising up-and-coming coach. He's obviously a Michigan dude, but also just is a good recruiter, has had a lot of success developing running backs. Seems like he'd have a lot of room to grow at Michigan. And I don't mind the Mike McDonald hire the more that I look at it, just because I didn't want a college retread. So even though you're taking a guy who's kind of a blank slate in college, at least it's a young blank slate, and he's been in a really successful system with the Ravens, and the NFL is looking a lot more like college football these days in terms of how offenses are run. So I'll at least be willing to wait and see what staff they put around him and what he's bringing to the table here. But I also do not expect Michigan to exactly, you know, leap back and have a 10-2 season or something like that. I think Harbaugh's probably still going to be very much fighting for his job next season.
Yeah, I just will say that, like, you know, whenever we talk about this, and even people on Twitter or wherever else that defend Harbaugh, it's always like, oh, he, you know, it's never like an affirmative case for why, like, things are going to be better. It's all why, like, he doesn't deserve to get fired yet. Like, there's nobody out there right now making an affirmative case for, like, oh, yeah, no, like, he's just about to turn this around. Like, it doesn't feel like anyone has a real, like, you know, any delusions that we're going to, like, get to the level we once hoped under Harbaugh, which is why I would have just rather them had them cut bait, you know, once they realized it was over, instead of, you know, trying to save some money and, like, hedge their bets or whatever.
Yeah, I know I've been clenching every time I see another NFL gig come open, even though Matt Campbell has said he's returning to Iowa State. I don't want anyone talking to him, and I want them to stay away. Don't want them even texting. No Twitter message, nothing. I want them away. But it does feel like, you know, the more you kick the can down the road, the more things can go awry, whether it's Harbaugh kind of keeping this team in a certain level of football purgatory by doing just well enough to not get fired, or the team missing out on the guy that they probably could have gotten this year. I would say definitely could have gotten this year if they'd wanted to push for him. And, you know, there might be more competition next year. You never know, especially if Campbell has another really good season at Iowa State. Maybe he gives, you know, the NFL a little bit more thought or something. You know, if he feels like he's, you know, kind of finished his business more at college, who knows? So, you know, you leave it up to chance, and that makes it a little scary. We will allow one and only one football question. It is from @BrusualSuspects on Twitter. Honest assessment of the football team's record and position in the division next season? Do they have a realistic hope of competing with Indiana or Penn State, let alone even keeping it within a few scores of Ohio State? And does it even matter if they lose to all three of those teams? Dan, I'll let you take that one first.
So, I mean, I don't know. The East is going to be a little bit weird next year. You know, Rutgers is going to come... It seems to be coming into competence, but they're still going to be Rutgers. I think Maryland could be a really interesting team. Certainly, you know, that offense started to round into form. Michigan State's probably still going to be pretty bad. I might even say worse than this year, because they have a couple of really good players graduating. And then, you know, you got Penn State that I think is a big candidate to, you know, have a pretty major bounce back. They kind of ended the year pretty strong. And then I'll be honest, Indiana, like, had a nice year last year, but I could see them regressing just because I think they got pretty lucky to, you know, have as many wins as they did. So I say that all to say that I think Michigan could beat any team in the East next year, or quite frankly lose to any team in the East next year not named Ohio State. And I mean, even Ohio State is, you know, definitely going to be the best team in the league again, but might not be like the absolute stone cold killer they were for the past 2 years, just because they lose, you lose Justin Fields, you lose a lot of talent on the offensive line, and at the receiver, you know, at the receiving group. So, you know, and they'll still be talented. They'll still be the best team in the league. But I think it's a more wide open league next year. And I could see, you know, like I said, I could see on any given Saturday, Michigan beating or losing to anyone in the league besides Ohio State, who they will lose to.
Yeah, and you make that point. But, I mean, we do have to take into account that Michigan would have won.
Exactly right, and that's the thing. True, I mean, you know, it's what will Michigan look like with the momentum coming in of, you know, beating Ohio State, or would have beating Ohio State. I don't know how you would really put that.
We're,
you know,
printing shirts, I swear.
It's a tough verb conjugation there, Dan.
we're training him in the group chat, but it hasn't translated to the podcast yet.
7-5. There you go.
Thank you for a tremendously straightforward answer, Alex. I am kind of feeling the 7-5, 8-4 borderline there, and I really hope that is not like the higher fire border, or I'm going to be yeah, real nervous throughout the whole season, but you know, you do get one legitimately difficult non-conference game in Washington, so you might not even have a clean record heading into conference season. You have to go to Wisconsin, you have to go to Indiana. Going to Nebraska, I mean, if Scott Frost can ever get Nebraska to have a pulse, this would be the year to do it and maybe get them to, you know, trip Michigan up in a game in Lincoln. Northwestern's defense should still be quite good, and maybe their offense improves under Mike Bajakian to the point where it's, you know, actually something to be worried about. Penn State, Dan mentioned, as a strong positive regression candidate, and that is a road game. Maryland is also a road game. That offense could be pretty explosive. They've got Rakeem Jarrett and Talia Tagovailoa. That's a pretty nice budding connection between those two. And then Ohio State. There are a lot of potential losses on the schedule. Now, a lot of those are also, you know, potential wins. Like you guys said, you know, all of them except Ohio State. So, I don't know. 7-5 feels about right. Especially with the amount of uncertainty just with the coaching staff right now. I'm sorry to end my time with you two on that note, because it's a little bit of a downer. but I'm going to let you two go, and I'm going to come around on the other side of this break, possibly with a backing track, possibly speaking in a little bit lower of a tone, taking it a little slower, and jamming to some fancy stats.
When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email jason@blankenshiplawyer.com. Are you ready? Let's dig into some fancy stuff. Michigan held Wisconsin to 29.7% shooting on two-pointers, which was the worst mark for the Badgers since they shot 25.7% on twos against Oklahoma on November 29, 2015. Defense wins championships and hearts. Wisconsin's last 20-point loss was on January 16, 2018, 92 games ago. They've only had four 20-point losses since the 2010-11 season. Thank you, Brendan Quinn, for that. Beatdowns are beautiful. Brad Davison went 1-for-8, and he didn't stop anyone's ability to get down. In Big Ten games, Michigan has four of the top 12 players in effective field goal percentage, four of the top 25 in block rate, and six of the top 40 in O-rating. That's group love.
All right. Few more. Hunter Dickinson is 49 for 68 on twos in Big Ten games. That's big energy. Franz Wagner is top 10 in the conference in minutes, O rating, effective field goal percentage, true shooting percentage, 2-point percentage, turnover rate, block rate, and steal rate. And he's 15th in defensive rebound rate and 25th in assist rate. The closest comp I can find for him on Bart Torvik is Zion Williamson. That's right there. Michigan is the first team in college basketball history to beat three ranked opponents in a row by at least 19 points. That's unprecedented in sexy. Meanwhile, Naz Hillman leads the country in PER, win shares, and points per game among high major players. Michigan is undefeated and ranked in the top 15 in both men's and women's basketball. Baby, they're never gonna stop. Thank you so much for listening to the Ace Pod. We are, as always, brought to you by the law offices of BJ's and Blankenship. Thank you to Alex and Dan for joining me today and for not joining me during this segment, which I recorded alone in my room when everybody else in the house was asleep. We will catch you next week. Fade me out.